You know, they say if you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all. I'm sorry. Yeah, keep going. I don't know where that came from. Go ahead. Oh, I think there's a K in Knucklehead.
This is Infants on Thrones. Philosophies of men mingled with humor. We are the Quark.
Listener's Essay.
Welcome back to another episode of Infants on Thrones. My name is Tom Perry, and today I'm joined with Glenn.
Are you telling me that my cravings for human flesh aren't normal?
And Glenn and I sit down with Keith, a listener who submitted his essay to us, and we talk to Keith about his essay, about his background, about his transition out of the church, the good and the bad of it. So, I hope you guys enjoy it.
Yeah, now when you're sitting there in your silk upholstered chair.
It seems history continues to teach us you can leave the church, but you can't leave it alone.
Now these dissenters, having the same instruction and the same information of the Nephites, yea, having been instructed in the same knowledge of the Lord, nevertheless, it is strange to relate, not long after their dissensions, they became more hardened and impenitent and more wild, wicked, and ferocious than the Lamanites, drinking in with the traditions of the Lamanites, giving way to indolence and all manner of lasciviousness, yea, entirely forgetting the Lord their God.
When I was born, I inherited something. As it turns out, it was something I didn't want, but it was given to me anyway. My brothers and sisters all received the same inheritance. Boy, girl, it didn't matter. Our birthright was the same. We were given Mormonism. Growing up, I was told that I had been saved as a special spirit to fight in the last days.
You are youth of the noble birthright.
Being Mormon wasn't just a marker of my identity. It was the marker, the one thing that would always be able to define me. I hit all the usual milestones. Baptism at 8, priesthood at 12,
the divine authority,
mission at 19, and married in the temple before I was 23. There are a few major events in my life up to that point that weren't tied to the church somehow. As I got older, though, more and more things that I heard taught in church seemed weird. I started to feel like the only one, a crazy person. I felt like I was the only one experiencing any doubt or questions. In Sunday school or elders' quorum, someone would say something that I found just utterly repugnant. And I'd look around and just see heads nodding up and down in approval. And I wanted to stand up and scream. I wanted to say,
doesn't anyone notice this? I feel like I'm taking crazy pills.
But what could I do? What really could I do? I was born Mormon. My family was Mormon. My wife was Mormon. My kids were Mormon. We all spoke the language. We all understood the culture. We all understood everything. So what could I do? I had to sit back and feel like the only one, the crazy person. Eventually, though, I had to ask myself that question. You know the question. That question that terrifies the believing member of the church. That question that once you ask it, cannot be unasked. What if the church isn't true? And I, like so many other members of the church before me, discovered that the moment I asked that question was the moment that I became most interested in all things Mormon. However, the very worst thing you can be is an apostate. You are now being perceived through an apostate lens. And through this lens, you cannot escape judgment of your every action. Anything you say can and probably will be used as an example as to how leaving the church breeds unhappiness. By way of example, when I was processing my feelings about the church, I was going to just try and fly under the radar. However, a few months before my oldest nephew got married, my temple recommend expired. And I wasn't in a space that I had any desire to renew it. I hadn't paid tithing in who knows how long. And I really, really had no desire to go to the temple at all. But this forced me out. In my attempts to not make a big deal about it, I just told my siblings, all of whom had different reactions. However, my extended family didn't know anything until the day of the wedding, when my poor wife attended the ceremony and I waited outside. I can only imagine the questions and stories that were passed around that day. I come from a close-knit family, so my nephew's wedding was an all-day affair, and I was happy to be a part of it. However, doing wedding stuff all day with three small kids in tow will wear you out. And by the end of the night, as I was leaving the reception, I was haggard, I was beat, I was just ready to collapse into bed. It so happens that this was when I ran into who you could call my favorite cousin. We were really just trying to get our kids home. We had hit the wall. The kids had hit the wall. Everyone was done. So in my exhaustion, I probably seemed a little curt to my cousin. The next week, she invites me to lunch, and I, of course, know why. Mostly because when my brother left the church, I went to lunch with him to get a handle on where he was coming from. When I got to lunch, she handed me a letter and a gift in a bag. She asked me to read the letter before we continued our conversation. Of course, in the letter, she brought out the old chestnut. When I saw you at the wedding, it looked like you had lost your light.
Does the light of Christ shine in your eyes?
Verily, I say unto you, nay.
And it was then that I realized that I was now being seen through different eyes. You are now being perceived through an apostate lens.
What's that? 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 What's that?
Well, first of all, damn, dude, we've gotten a few essays, and none of them are quite up to par with the editing skills that you put in, man. You've got, like, clips and music and...
I figured if I was going to submit an essay to y'all, I might try my hand at making it fit with what you guys do, so...
Oh, so we made you up your game
a little bit, because otherwise I just would have sat... Well, and either way, even with this particular essay, I just had an outline of stuff, and I had, like, 15 different topics, and I just recorded everything just kind of off the cuff and then pastiched it together the best way I could till I got sick of dealing with it.
So you didn't actually put a title on this. You just called it Keith.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the whole idea behind it is that idea of the apostate lens, though.
Yeah.
It, your whole life gets seen differently, no matter what.
You're being judged through the Mormon lens of the, or the believing Mormon lens from everyone else.
Yeah.
So what would that be? It'd be the, it's not exactly rose colored glasses, but it's something along there. You could. I'm trying to help you with the title here.
Well, I don't know. Man. I'm not a wordsmith unless I'm writing shitty pop music. So.
Do you write music?
Oh yeah. No, that's so. I have a little home studio, and it makes it easier. I've got a professional sound editing software and all that, so that makes the editing and that sort of thing with the essay a lot easier.
Okay, so let's start to hash this out.
Okay,
so at the very beginning, you put some clips in there, and I'd have to ask because I listened to the very beginning of those clips, trying to pinpoint, because you know I've had like little red flags going off in my mind, like, ooh, I've heard these.
Uh-huh.
Is the first one where they're talking about the Lamanites, is that from the Living Scriptures?
No, that's just straight up, and I don't know if this makes any difference, that's just straight up from the audio recording you can pull off of lds.org.
oh, really?
Yeah, you can download like the whole damn Book of Mormon in MP3 format.
Sure. Yeah, of
and
course.
So I just downloaded that chapter and, you know, chopped that out of there.
Oh, that's where that came from.
Yeah.
That's hilarious, because I really thought that was like a clip from, you know, that animated series.
Well,
from
the voice is so ominous. Imagine listening to the whole goddamn thing in that voice, because that's how the whole book sounds. The first time my wife ever, quote unquote, read the Book of Mormon was listening to the MP3s from LDS.org. This was several years ago, and I'm like, I don't know how you could do that.
Well, because it's inspired. That's how you do it. It doesn't really matter how they read it.
Shit, still shit, no matter how you serve it, Tom.
All right, yeah, fine.
And then the other clip is Glenn Pace. And that was the only conference talk where I could find that old drivel about they can leave the church, but they can't leave it alone.
He's a 70, is that right?
Yeah, that particular clip was from like 1985 or 6 or some distant past.
So that cliche or that trope, does that bug you as much as it bugs me?
Yes. That's how, the whole essay was going to just be about that, and it kind of took a left turn and went in a less pissed off direction. But
what bothers you guys about that? Go ahead. Yeah, you were starting to answer.
Yeah. Well, though, for me, it's just this idea that so here I'm 35 years old, and I spent my first 32 years of life in the church, right, and doing all the church stuff. And like I said in the essay, going. I baptized and got my priesthood and did everything, got married in the temple. I veered a little bit by waiting to have kids for a couple of years, but in every other way, I was on track. I was talking to a buddy of mine who said, like, between the two of us, if we went back to church, we know exactly what we'd need to do to eventually become bishops and stake presidents and all that, because there's a game you can play as a male in the church. So I did all of that stuff.
So wait, but before you go on, though, mm-hmm. Keith, what did you score on Bob's Mormon cred scale?
I was celestial. I can't remember exactly what the number was. It was either 85 or 90.
85 or 90? Are you okay. Serious?
Yeah.
You got over 80?
It was pretty high. I know it was over 80 for sure. Wow. The only things I missed were I didn't attend a church school, and I had left the church before my oldest was old enough to get baptized, and those were the two things that – but everything else – everything else, it was like, yep, 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 yep.
Because that is the new gold standard.
You know? Yeah, the new gold. To score high on Bob's bullshit scale.
Yeah.
Hey.
Sorry, Bob. I actually quite enjoyed it. But that's because I scored high. And I think that's going to be the common thing you see when people score low. They're like, fuck you! When people score high, they're like, yeah.
Yeah, see, what we don't know now is that 10 years from now, like Glenn said, this is going to be the gold standard. People will be saying, where did you score on the Bob Pritz scale?
Right, yeah. They'll be like, I remember exactly where I was when I first heard about the Bob Cred scale.
Yeah, really. Are you was life-altering, dude.
Are you guys sure you're not just overemphasizing your reach just a little?
Not ours, his.
Okay.
Yeah.
Bob's.
Yeah.
You need some pats on the back after being slapped in the face so many times over it. So,
as I said, I enjoyed it, but of course I scored really high on it. So it was reaffirming to me that I can say anything I want because I scored high.
Did it make you feel good that you scored high? Did it make you feel bad that you scored high?
I'd have to say both, because on the good side, you're just like, yep, okay, I can bitch about this all I want. And on the bad side, you can be like, I spent that much of my life following this preset script that was for me, just laid out, and I'm like, okay, whatever, I'll do it. And you kind of feel like a dumbass after that.
It's gonna take you a long time for that decay rate to finally wither down to nothing, man.
I figure I'll die before that happens.
I don't know. Fair enough. You know, like I think about people that are raised in other tradition, and you know, Mormonism is a really high context group, you know, there's a lot to it. So, mm-hmm. you know, there's people that grow up in other cultural traditions that aren't as pervasive into their everyday life. But I think there's some kind of value of being able to come out of whatever it is that you grew up in and look at it from the outside. So I kind of get a sense from you, Keith, and maybe I'm wrong, but that there's a little, like you said, you're not angry about it. You're kind of okay about it.
Uh-huh.
But when you talk about, and I'm not just saying you specifically, this is the general you, that when people talk about being raised Mormonism, it's like with a bunch of regret and like all the other cool things that I could have done if I hadn't been raised Mormon. Like I don't quite understand that.
I don't really regret growing up that way. It's just there were things where it could be like my life could have been different, not in the sense that I could have been drinking myself into the grave when I was 22 or anything like that. And I'm one of those people where I say, I don't regret my mission at all. Like, it was a really cool time. I met some really amazing people. I was the kind of missionary I wanted to be, as opposed to the kind that I was supposed to be.
Where'd you serve?
Northern Brazil in Manaus.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm one of them. But it's like, oh yeah, Brazil. Everybody goes to Brazil.
No, really? Not quite. Us stateside guys always think of anybody that's foreign as the upper echelon of missionaries. So go on.
Was Rio in your mission?
No. So I was in the north. Rio's in the southeast.
Okay.
And my mission, though, was interesting because at the time it was the largest geographic area for a mission. So, like, we got transferred by airplane and boat and 12-hour bus ride and all sorts of stuff. It was just insane. Because it's basically just the rainforest, the Amazon wow. rainforest. Really cool. And maybe that's why I don't regret it. Because if I'd gone to, like, Cleveland, I might be saying different things about my mission in terms of that. But but I don't regret growing up in the church. You just kind of, from my point of view now, you kind of feel silly about certain things that you embraced because they seem silly to me now. And I understand that they're very important to other people, and that's why I try and be pretty respectful about it. But to me, I did a Mormon Expression Voices interview a few weeks back, and my in-laws wanted to listen to it. And my wife listened to it and said, well, you might want to warn them about this part and this part and this part. Because I got pretty candid about it, talking about how in the big picture, the LDS church is pretty insignificant on the world stage. It's a pretty small church based out of a pretty small city. When you're looking at the big picture, and its impact on the world is minimal.
Yeah.
But its impact on the people who interact with it on a daily basis is a lot bigger. But
that sounds like outsider talk, though, Keith. I mean, you know that, right?
Yeah, I know, but I scored like over 80 on Bob's cred scale. So. Yeah.
But it's true. I part of my job, I travel all around the world and interact with people, Australia, Brazil, Europe. I always having interactions. And they always ask me, because I spent 3 years in Japan with this company. And so they ask me how I learned Japanese. And I always hate answering that question because for the same reason, I don't like it if people see that I went to BYU and they go, oh, BYU, there's like, mm-hmm. I just can't get over that. But whenever it does come out, it doesn't mean anything to them, they couldn't care less. And it doesn't have all of the baggage for them that it does for me, so I think that speaks to what you said about that Mormonism really isn't that big of a deal to the rest of the world as we think it is to us, having been raised in it, So like even coming out of it, the embarrassment that I have on certain things, like when I tell people now that I went on a mission, they don't exactly know what I mean by that. They think of like mm-hmm. this Christian service mission or something where I was actually doing good, So they don't have the negative slant that I do with it. They think, oh, that's kind of cool. You were like the Peace Corps. I'm like, okay. Yeah, we taught English classes for free once a week for an hour.
Does your reaction change at all, though, Glenn, when you interact with – I mean, obviously this is the rare, but if you have to describe that situation with Mormons or even
– Oh, and I do. I mean, there's some Mormon guys that I work with and that are still active. And so I still haven't been in the situation where we're like at dinner and I'm having a glass of wine and they're not. Like, I don't think it would surprise them at this point. But
mind. Does that mean you left some signs, like you've left apostasy cards behind? I mean, what does that mean?
Well, they know I don't go to church. One of them is the Elders Quorum president, and he hasn't seen me for 3 years. So,
oh, so he's in your ward?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh.
Well, one guy is. Another guy was in my ward, and then he moved to Denver. And like when the Book of Mormon musical came out, and I had a bootleg copy of it, I took it with me. We were actually in Sao Paulo for a meeting and we were in the hotel and I'm like, oh, you got to watch some of this. And so we sat down and we watched about 10, 15 minutes of it. He's like, I got to go. And he just wasn't, as interested in it as I was. But
Brother Austin, you've offended me way too much. I'm out. I'm out.
Yeah. It's weird. Cause like when you're around really cool Mormons, you think, oh, okay, they're cool. So we can have this conversation. And as soon as it goes in a certain direction, they're like, I got to go. I got to get out.
every time.
You look like Potiphar's wife to me.
You don't know what a really cool Mormon is. The really cool Mormon would say, that crosses the line, brother.
Oh, that's the definition of cool.
A really cool Mormon just doesn't go to church anymore, so it doesn't
matter.
Yeah.
Right, right.
Actually, that's not true. One of my very best friends is like super, super believing, and he's probably one of the coolest people I know. But that's because he's still one of those guys who attests, says, I know that it's true, but he always says, but I know it doesn't work for everybody, you know, but it's brought me, you know, it's that, that same old thing where it's like, but, you know, it improves my life. And
that's probably how you guys are still friends, though, because if he had levels of judgment on you, then it probably wouldn't work.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. But like I said, I let the – in my leaving the church, I've just kind of let the people filter themselves out of my life if that's what they wanted to do. And it hasn't happened very often. And either that's because I know really, really cool people or somehow I am unoffensive, but I don't know.
Well, so on that topic, what happened with your cousin? Like, has your cousin filtered herself out of your life? Or
She hasn't. And that's
the climax of the essay there.
It was such a surprising thing. And the thing was just so surprising because of who she is and the relationship that we have. Hang on.
Because you thought she was cool.
Well,
I think we're picking up on a theme here. The people that you think are cool, and then you find out that they're not. It could be really confusing.
Yeah.
But that was the surprising thing. But this is where I get all confessional. I wrote probably nearly the same letter to another one of our cousins when I was a missionary. Even the whole bullshit about,
look
like you've lost your light, that whole thing.
You did
that? I did. And that's why it was so shocking to me, because I'm like, wait a second. I did that. And I felt like.
But you were a missionary at that time. So you were in a special mindset.
Well, a special mindset.
This was karma coming around to bite you in the ass.
It totally was. There's a reason I didn't mention it in the essay, because it makes me look like an ass. But I figure if they make it all the way through that, okay, well, now they can know that I'm an ass like anyone else. And so it was just surprising to me, because I hadn't expected it from this particular cousin. I was a judgmental prick. I mean, I just was. I look back on who I was, especially as a missionary, I was Joe Rule follower. Like, I hear these stories about guys doing anything outside of the, you know, the rules on their missions. And I'm just like, wow, I didn't do any of that.
You wouldn't streak naked through an elementary school?
No.
Or listen to music. Yeah, right.
None of that. I had one big rule-breaking moment. And on our mission, we weren't allowed to travel to and from a location unless we were in our official missionary attire. They don't have a name for it in Brazil. But, you know, the white shirt and the tie and everything. So even service projects, we had to travel to the service project in our proselyting uniform. And then we could change our clothes at the service project, do our service, change back into our uniform, come back home. And so my biggest rule breaking thing I ever did is once I put on normal clothes and I went for a walk, and I forced my companion to come with me even. And that was it. I walked for about 6 blocks in this little dinky town called Umaita in the middle of northern Brazil. And that was it. That was my big rebellion for my whole mission.
Yeah, that doesn't even sound like a rule.
Right?
Break, man.
How did you feel? Did you feel like you were really
I walked about half the distance that I had intended to, because I was having guilt.
Yeah. Did you fast for repentance and all that crap after? Like,
no, but there was
my heart weighs heavy now.
There was a time, and this is just stupid to do, but because I'm in northern Brazil and it's hot, where we would fast every Sunday. And we'd go like the full 24 hours, no drinking, you know, no water, nothing. And I probably could have gotten dehydrated. But it's one thing I learned as a missionary is that missionaries are stupid.
Yeah, I did the fast without water in the deep heat of the Midwest. Mm-hmm. And there was a couple times where I thought, this has got to be dangerous, because I remember thinking, I think I'm legitimately experiencing dehydration right now. I think so.
Well, one of my favorite memories, but I'm pretty sure it was a dangerous sensation, is after one of those, we got to somebody's house and they offered us some Fanta grape soda that was cold. And so I took this glass of Fanta grape soda and I started just chugging it. And I could feel my skin's temperature start to go down as I was drinking the cold soda. And it was a really cool feeling, but I'm fairly certain that that's not how it's supposed to go.
Bad sign.
Like my arms, I could feel my arms get just colder. Like my sweat was finally able to be like, oh, okay, here we go. But no, I was hardcore rule guy. And so a lot of stuff could have come and bit me in the ass. But so far, I've had probably the best exit of anybody I've ever heard of, with the exception of the fact that everybody looks at me differently now. But I've not had the calls to repentance and the disownment of the family. It's just that now my whole life is passing through a filter where everything means something else.
So no shunning, huh? No judgment. No letters of warning like,
well, I mean,
Keith.
There was one from my cousin that was right, like, yeah, you just yeah, need yeah. me. And I had a sister who made me, I have one sister who was just like, you know what? Whatever you do, I love you. Our relationship won't change. Let me know how you want it to look. Let me know, you know, what makes you uncomfortable and we're cool. I had another sister who felt like she had to really make a big deal about it. But based on the experience, she was just being dramatic for drama's sake. And then, and then I have another sister that made me promise to read the Book of Mormon as much as I read anything anti-Mormon. And I'm like, well, that's easy because I'm not reading anything anti-Mormon. At the time, I was reading a bunch of like Bart Ehrman and and I don't know that you could specifically consider that anti-Mormon.
Anti-Christian, maybe.
Well, that depends on your point of view. It's,
right, yeah.
You know,
exactly.
I was reading John Spong, who if somebody's trying to stay quote-unquote Christian while not believing in any of the magic of it, John Spong is who to read.
Okay.
But
I've never heard that name before.
He was an Episcopalian bishop, and he decided to go start trying to teach people to be decent Christians without believing in all of the, well, most of the supernatural. Like he did an interview once, and this YouTube clip got passed around all over, where he basically said that he believed that hell was an invention of religion to control the populace, and that's an interesting.
I think I've seen that, yeah. But I didn't know who it was. Okay.
Yeah,
but
you know, a member telling you to read the Book of Mormon to counter any anti-Mormon literature, it just really doesn't understand the mindset of somebody who's going through these questions. Because reading the Book of Mormon, because I would do that, but you have to read the Book of Mormon without, you've got to promise you won't think about it.
Yeah, well, no,
you, know,
like
you
I
won't
said,
think it's... about what you're reading, and it's, you know, like. It talks about the white and delights him in the skin changing thing. And you're like, oh, man, OK, I'm going to have to skip that part of the Book of Mormon.
Well,
that's
not
edifying anymore.
We have to skip most of it.
Yeah,
I think when they give you that challenge, it's also under the basis of that assumption towards the end with Moroni's challenge. Like you'll get on your knees and pray to see if it's true again. And boom.
Right. Oh, well, it's that kind of magical. There's just something about doing that the spirit is going to come in through your eyeballs. And get into your heart. The light that you've lost is going to come back in because it's the Book of Mormon is the source of that light.
Yeah, well, of course, because how could anybody have written that just wonderful, complex piece of literature? It's it's been torn apart over and over again and still stands the test of time, Glenn, or not.
Guys smarter than you and me have researched this and still believe it's true. So
See, but I doubt the guys smarter than me in some ways. I guess. Just to me, it seems like it's once you. So what happened with me is like I deconstructed Christianity, and that's how the church ended up falling apart for me. Because when I realized that you know Jesus of Nazareth never started a church, the whole restoration narrative just kind of falls apart. And now I lost my train of thought. What were we talking about? To my cousin,
well, I had asked you the question about filtering. You know, the maybe
well, yeah,
that was
so,
when we started going
yeah.
off. And with your cousin.
Regardless, I've had really pretty positive things. My cousin gave me a letter. My aunt sent me a letter, and I gave it to my wife to read first. And my wife read it and said, "Yeah, you probably don't want to read this right now." And I said, "Okay."
So, is your wife is still active?
She is not. She's not currently active. I'd say the way we explain it to people is we're in the same book, but we're not on the same page.
Hmm.
We're both super agnostic about everything. I lean towards non-belief while she leans toward some types of belief.
But so, neither so of very... you attend.
No. Okay. We went to a baby blessing today, and that was an interesting experience. I was hoping for some fast and testimony meeting awesomeness, and it was just as boring as it always was.
Oh, I had fast and testimony meeting awesomeness today. I went today. It was great.
I had a water balloon fight with my kids in the backyard.
Show off.
Well.
But, I mean, dude, fast and testimony meeting, I was telling this to my daughter because she was like, this is so boring. I was like, what are you talking about? This is like open mic night for Mormons. What you get your hodgepodge or potluck of crazy. And every once in a while, somebody gets up there and says something that just brings a smile to my face. I just love it, love it, love it.
Yeah, I was hoping for some of that. For the first little bit, I was walking the hall with my one-year-old. And it was funny because the last time we were going to church, my three-year-old was one. And I saw my buddy who'd blessed his kids out in the hall. And I'm like, you know, last time I was in church, this was still church. So nothing's changed for me. I'm still walking a kid around the hall.
That's awesome. How old's your oldest kid?
I've got four. So my oldest is 8. He's almost 9. And I got a 5-year-old who's almost 6. And then the 3-year-old and the 1-year-old.
So did you, I assume you went through your crisis before he went through the 8, the baptism thing?
Or yeah. Like, yeah. He was 5 when I first, like, came out, first told my wife what was going on. Mm-hmm. And that was after probably about 3 years of me trying to run the gauntlet without talking to anybody. And that's one of the things I was trying to get across in my essay, is that just sitting there feeling like a crazy person, feeling like you're the only one in the whole room who thinks what's being said is just absolutely horrendous. Like, not just, oh, that's weird, but like awful, you know, going through. And it's one of my great shames that Prop 8 didn't break me, but City Creek did, because the stuff that was getting thrown around in church during Prop 8 was just the most horrible stuff you could say about anyone. And there I am, just kind of sitting there like, well, this is weird, and looking around and everybody's just nodding their head, and it was mind-boggling. And that, I don't know, it was such a hard thing to process. And I did that for about, I want to say, 2 years, 2.5 years before I told my wife what was going on. And to her credit, she was really, really cool about it.
Well, that's cool too, because yeah, it sounds like a lot of things went your way.
everything that could possibly go right when you're defecting from the church or whatever you want to call it, everything that could go right with that for me did. And I recognize that. When I talk to friends of mine who are going through this and people I know who are getting divorced over this shit, it's just like, I look at my life and I look at my family relationships and my friend relationships, and very few people have opted out of my life. And the ones that have are people that I wasn't very close to begin with. And so that either means that I did something right, or that I've just always been around really cool people. Because even my cousin, who we went and had this conversation, and she interpreted my being tired as having lost my light, we still have a decent relationship and we still communicate. It was just eye-opening for me to be on the other side of that fence, especially since I had done that same thing to another cousin of ours.
Right, right, right. So in your essay, you talk about the Mormon identity was everything to you, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you switched. Now you have an apostate identity.
Mm-hmm.
And now everyone's looking and judging you through this lens.
Mm-hmm.
And do you, well, two questions. One, what would you do, or like, what could you say to help them maybe change that lens, or maybe judge you less? Or is there a fix, or have you even thought about it? And then two, do you exercise any level of judgment against them? And it sounds like you don't, but just go ahead and clarify.
Well, I don't know that there's a fix. I don't know that there's anything that can be said. I don't think that somebody who believes and is fully invested in their church experience can really wrap their brain around somebody like myself who's opted out. Because it doesn't make any sense to them why anybody would opt out, especially if they're fully invested in the experience, especially if they feel it brings them greater happiness. So I don't know that there's anything you can say to someone to shift that. You just kind of have to be okay with it. You just, and there's a lot of ex-Mormons that try and overcompensate towards the, look how great I am, life is awesome. But the reality is your day-to-day doesn't change. You don't get rich or get poor after you leave the church. You don't, you know, sometimes your relationships implode, but I do blame the church and the way they teach things for that. But it's, for the most part, you stay the same person, at least in my experience with a lot of people I know. And there's a ton of guys my age who are going through this and who are trying to navigate whether they want to continue to engage with the church or not.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so I don't know that there's some magical thing you can say to somebody other than what I've had to say, and this came out before because I used to just say whatever I wanted to, and it impacted some friendships of mine in a negative way, where I always have to frame everything I say in terms of, well, based on my experience and based on what I've read, and, you know, other people have read what I've read and they've come to a different conclusion and I'm okay with that. This is just what makes sense for me. And also I allow people to think that I'll come back someday, because I don't care if they think I'll come back someday. And I think there are some people in the ex-Mormon community where it's just like, well, I don't want anyone to hold out that hope that I'll come back to church. And to me, it's just like, what harm is that doing? You know, it's not actually impacting your life for your parents to put your name on the prayer roll at the temple. It's doing nothing. It's like, anyhow, but
I want to challenge something that you said, though, because I keep thinking about this, that you're the same person that you were before the faith crisis, that you haven't really changed. And because you also made such a big deal about Mormon identity, that mm-hmm. it really was your identity and was your world. And then that falls away. How could you not change? And especially from a believer's perspective, that you're the same person that you've mm-hmm. always been, when you've always been so completely 100% defined by Mormonism.
And I guess I just quantify a lot of things in a different way. Whereas I'm still the same husband that I was. I'm still just as devoted to my wife and kids. I'm still just as into helping people, you know. So in terms of when your life is defined by your Mormon identity, and mine was, because your life is laid out for you. You know, the thing that maybe the church does best is say, this is what your life is going to look like, and here are your milestones, you know. And these go all the way through when you get married, and then you have your milestones or having kids. And then if you're a guy, your milestones are how far you advance in leadership. And then if you advance to a certain point, of course, you're going to be a Mormon rock star. Or if you don't, then your next milestone is when you get to a certain age, you and your wife go and do the adult mission thing. But everything's laid out for you. And so when I talk about being like so fully invested in Mormonism, it's because every aspect of my life was defined by what milestone I was hitting inside of the church.
I just got to say, when you said adult mission, this like boom, chaka, wah, like porn music came into my mind, and I haven't been able to get it out.
You don't have to share everything that goes on in your head, Glenn.
I mean, I don't think anybody wants that image, man.
I stopped listening at Adult Mission. And I'm like, so I just needed to pause and breathe for a second and get back.
All right. And so when I talk about being like definitively Mormon, it's because your whole life is framed in that. You know, whether or not you're a returned missionary, what leadership positions you've held, that sort of thing. But who you are on the inside, the type of person you are, the way that you interact with your family and your loved ones. And maybe it does change for people. And maybe it's just that I was already a shitty Mormon to begin with. And all I did was meet the checklist requirements. You know
what does that mean?
Oh, like that I hit all the milestones. You know, but I wasn't. And maybe I wasn't fully. I don't know. I mean, I did score high on Bob's cred scale. But sometimes I feel like because I... Well, here's a story for that. When my wife and I first got married, it's just the two of us. And so we're waking up in the morning, we're praying over breakfast, we're at dinner, we're praying over dinner. And she said to me one night, she's like, oh, do you want to have, you know, couples prayer? And I looked at her and I said, why? Because it didn't make any sense to me. We'd kind of already addressed all of our prayer issues throughout the day. And by the end of the day, it was like, are we going to just say the same thing that we already said at breakfast and at dinner? But we're saying it again, so something else is going to happen. And like, so there are certain aspects where like Mormonism didn't make sense to me. The concept of back tithing never made sense to me. When you'd go into your bishop and be like, oh, I got a little behind. I haven't been able to pay tithing for a couple
months.
Are you
serious? That didn't make sense to you when you were a believer?
No, because it was just like, well, wait a second. It's not like there's this running total. It's like when you get baptized, they're like, okay, well, up until your baptism, your total income was about, let's say, $280,000 for the last so many years. So we're going to need you to cut us a check for $28,000.
Well,
it's just like, well, you can't go back and change it, you know, not paying tithing, or if you were, you know, lying about something. The whole idea is that you stop whatever the behavior is, you initiate the new behavior. I mean, this is repentance, right? You stop whatever the negative, you know, quote unquote negative behavior was. You initiate
restitution. But restitution's a part of the repentance
process.
Damn
right. Yeah, that's where my brain started. But, well, kind of
but so what you're illustrating right now, though, Keith, I mean, when you said earlier, maybe I was just a shitty Mormon all the way. So you're saying that, like, not doing couple prayers, not feeling that drive to pay the full tithing if it's back tithing, you know, things mm-hmm. like that. Since you were like that when you were a Mormon, then not doing them as a former Mormon, there's not much change there. Is that what you're...
Yeah. Yeah. Well, because like who I am and the type of person that I am and mm-hmm. still the way that I interact with my relationships hasn't changed substantially. I don't go out and I don't talk like my best buddy who's like a hardcore believer. I don't go and try and tear down his shit. I just let him do his thing. And in return, he lets me do my thing and we can coexist.
And okay, but if he did tear down your thing, like if he didn't treat you with respect, that you might feel
then he would have filtered himself out of my life at that point.
Possibly, but if you felt like you wanted to keep him in your life, maybe you'd feel like, you know, I'm just teach this guy a lesson. I'm going to treat him just like he's treating me, right?
Well, that's just not who I am.
All right, fair enough.
I'm just not that guy. And I understand, it's like even in the essay I say, I understand that there's people where that's like important to them. You know, I look at dudes like Mike Norton and it's like, I get that's important to him. That's a whole lot of time and energy put into something that I just don't see as being beneficial in my own life. You know, trying to get somebody to go through the hell that processing your way out of the church is just because you want them to. I mean,
well, I don't think it's necessarily just because you want them to. Isn't it essentially just like when you were in a missionary, just in reverse, right?
Where, but again, like I said, I wasn't that. I was the kind of missionary I wanted to be. So if somebody
right.
said to me, "No, man, I'm hardcore Catholic, and I've been Catholic my whole life," and they actually were attending and they had no interest, I'm like, "Okay, cool," and I was on my way.
Okay, so when the mission president said, you know, Elder, are you getting X amount of baptisms that you said that you would for your goal? You're not meeting this goal. You don't feel guilty about that. Like, oh, yeah,
no.
Sorry, President. I got to get up on. I got to speed it up here.
Nope.
Oh,
and
wow.
And the weird thing was I was a zone leader and everything. I was a damned branch president as a missionary. And I had the worst baptism numbers because I didn't care about that. Most of my mission was spent going and finding people who'd been baptized and figuring out what was going on with them. Because I mean, it's South America. So you've got the in the front door, out the back door situation going on. And there's people I met who are like, oh yeah, I remember that. Yeah. I felt bad for that poor missionary. And I decided to just make him happy and do what he wanted me to. And then, I mean, this is Brazilian people though. This is not uncommon. Like they just want to make you feel good about yourself. And I met more than one person where that was the case, where there was just like, he just was so earnest and like wanted this so bad that I just did it because it didn't mean anything to me, but it meant something to him. And so my mission president never actually had that conversation with me. I never got hit for numbers. I never got chastised for not hitting numbers.
Wow, this is so fascinating. This is like you're an aberration or something.
I kind of am, and I know that.
Because if your mission president in Brazil wasn't numbers oriented. This is,
I had two different mission presidents when I was down.
Okay.
And the one that was there when I was first there, I don't even think he knew who I was. I don't think he had any idea of where I was or what I was doing because the mission being so large, the mission home was in a city called Manaus. And I, for most of my mission, I was at least a 3-hour airplane ride away from the mission home. So I was just out in the middle of nowhere for most of it. And the mission president, when I got there, was at the end of his term. So he wasn't coming around the mission every month doing big zone conferences. I saw him when I got there and I saw him when he was leaving.
Holy cow.
And then the new guy, well, it was just such a big mission. The logistics of going and visiting all of these idiot kids in a geographical area that big is just astounding.
Yeah, that's true.
The new guy got there, and he started out doing everything. He was coming out every month and doing zone conferences. And I think he realized that it wasn't smart to do. It wasn't cost-effective, if anything. And he kind of stopped doing it, too. And so I probably had zone conferences every other month for the bulk of my mission. And I was only in the city where the mission home is for about 3.5 months of my entire mission. Outside of that, I was an airplane ride away, and he just trusted. But because I was such a hardcore rule guy, and I kind of had a reputation as being that rule guy, I think that he just didn't care. He's like, all right, well, I know he's not out, you know, feeling up some 14-year-old girl like, you know, these 18 other guys in the mission. He's fine. Just let him go.
So why were you such a rule guy if you seemed so laid back and kind of like, let's just let people be who they want to be. It kind of,
I mean, I kind of feel like you obey the rules so you can have the spirit more, so you can convert more. It's like a chain reaction.
It's exactly that, though. I felt like if I obey the rules, the good stuff will just happen.
Okay.
You know, if I obey the rules, I was all on board with the supernatural belief. It's like, okay, if I obey all of the rules, then God will bless me. And so I was obeying the rules, and I just figured that I'd be blessed with whatever experiences needed to happen. I'd be blessed to have the people come into my life that needed to come into my life that I could help. And that happened sometimes, but generally, there were people who were already members of the church who sometimes didn't even really know it. So I spent most of my time reactivating people.
Okay, all right. But I got to ask you about the one point in your essay where you say, you know, you ask that dreaded question, the one question that changes mm-hmm. for, you know, changes. It's like the pivotal moment in everybody's life when they go through this crisis of faith is when you really genuinely ask yourself, could the church not be true?
Mm-hmm.
Walk me through that. Like, where were you in the stage of your life? Because, you know, you talk about when you were in, like, Elder's Quorum or whatever, and you were kind of looking around like, does nobody else get this? This is awful.
Uh-huh.
Was it after that, or was it before that?
It was after that. It was
okay.
So I was going through all this, and I wasn't telling anybody about it. And then I had a buddy. Well, so I was playing in a band at the time, and me and the drummer, after band practice, would just essentially end up standing out in front of the guitarist house where we rehearsed, talking for like 2 or 3 hours at a time. And I was talking to him, and he was the first person I opened up to about, like, that I was just having trouble believing any of this. It was really hard to wrap my brain around.
Was he Mormon?
Yeah. He's actually a church employee.
Wow. All right.
Yeah. Yeah. One of these days, his story is interesting. Anyhow, the guitarist was taking some garbage out, and he kind of overheard what we were talking about. And he came out and he said, well, hold up. Before you just throw everything out, I'm going to send you a bunch of podcasts to listen to. And so he turned me on to Mormon Stories and, you know, the same old thing goes where you end up finding anything Mormon related that you can, and you start listening to it because you feel less crazy, especially when you're listening to like certain episodes of Mormon Stories where they're still kind of trying to approach it from a faithful way, or even like listening to Dan Weatherspoon tie himself in knots on Mormon Matters.
Yeah, those are specific kind of knots.
Yeah.
They're what knots.
Sorry, Dan. I love Dan. I think he's a wonderful guy. I don't know how he does it. But
how he's a wonderful guy?
No, how he performs those amazing feats of gymnastics with his brain. And so that moment of like, what if it's not true, kind of occurred to me in a weird way. It was actually a Mormon Matters podcast, and there was one about happiness, and they had the true believing guy on saying why being a true believer is the way to be happy, and then they had Jared Anderson on saying why it's okay to be the middle way guy. And then they had Greg Rockwell on saying why, you know, being an apostate is the way to be happy. And Jared said something on that podcast where he just said, you know, look, if you're not happy right now, then it's probably not worth the risk. And that just exploded my whole worldview in that sense. Cause it was just like, well, wait a second. I'd never considered engaging with the church and engaging with religion as being risky behavior. I always fell on the other side of Pascal's wager, where it's like, okay, even if it's not, I'm going to live as though it is, because then if it is, I'm golden. And I had never considered that living my whole life in that way and being miserable was risky behavior. And that's when I was able to ask myself that question. And when I was able to say, well, what if it's not true? Everything opened up. Like, the church does a great job of laying out what it is and trying to make sense of everything, and it creates this beautiful chain of something. But for me, life made infinitely more sense from the other side.
See, when you describe that moment, because that's where like the flood of memories come into my mind. I still like vivid memories of that night when I asked myself that question, mm-hmm. when I finally settled in. I can remember like everything, just like I can remember, you know, the birth of all my children together or whatever. Yeah. It's so nuts because, like you said, it does make sense. Everything kind of fits into place. But I don't know about you, and I don't know about you either, Glenn. But I got this like awful sense of dread. It really reminds me of Julia Sweeney's letting go of God. Beautiful. I love that.
Uh-huh.
Where she says, I just put on the glasses to look just for a minute, what life would be like without God, just for a second. And like, she's like, and it was the scariest thing I've ever experienced in my entire life. Like, we're on this rock in the middle of space. Like, ah, I can't believe this is happening. That's exactly how I felt. Like, this enormous amount of dread sunk in. Like, the afterlife started flooding my mind. And realizing that, you know, I don't have a soul. Like, this is meaningless. Like, and I don't know. It's like I just got flooded with this. All the uncertainty just came in all at once. And I was like, this can't be. And I kind of felt, I don't know, completely out of balance. It felt weird. Well, but it's scary.
That's why people won't ask the question. Sorry, I just got a text message. That's why people won't ask the question, because it's scary. I mean, just entertaining the little bit when you talk about Julia Sweeney, where she's like, I just, you know, put on the glass for that minute. But it's just like, just entertaining the thought that it might not be what you've been taught it is your entire life is scary enough that most people just cut the thought off before it happens.
Yeah.
And then when you work your way to the point where you're like, I really have to think about this, like, you have to work up to that question. It's not a question where you're just driving along and it just occurs to you to be like, huh, oh, what if the church isn't true? What if everything I've taught my whole life isn't the reality of the universe? You don't just randomly have that thought, because you spend your whole, all of your time fighting that thought. But when you work up to have the courage to really consider the world, to look at the world as though your whole worldview is erroneous, it's scary enough that you don't ever want to do it. And then when you do it, yeah, it is kind of depressing. Because again, you've had this narrative laid out for you. And don't get me wrong, so like I say, when I say that I miss it sometimes, it can be considered a beautiful narrative as long as you're thinking inside of a very limited idea. You know, the whole Mormon concept of eternal life and, you know, this, the plan of happiness and all of that. If you're able to confine yourself to just the very best of what that is, it's a beautiful timeline. You know, why would you entertain thoughts that would pull you outside of that?
It's true.
And you just take all that time. And once you get there, and it's that question that you dread asking. And when you finally get to the point where you can ask it, where you can say, what does the world look like? What does the world look like if the church isn't in fact what it claims to be? You can't go back from that. To me, that's when they talk about the genie back in the bottle or the toothpaste back in the tube. To me, that doesn't have anything to do with what you've read or what you've studied or what you've researched. It has to do with when you hit that point where you can honestly ask yourself that question.
Yeah, because it's same for me. I envision like my shelf actually like full on collapsing at that point. And then I, you know, I'm trying to put the shelf back up, but it's broken. It's gone.
Yeah.
Well, and you're just looking around like, oh shit.
Well, and my wife has a similar way that she explains it, because she's had to explain to a couple of her friends what she's gone through. And she says, it's like you have this fortress that your whole life has built. Like, it's this big, beautiful fortress. And then you go through a crisis of faith or whatever you want to call it, and the foundation underneath your fortress just disintegrates. And then your whole thing just crumbles, and you're just kind of left sifting through the rubble, trying to figure out what you want to keep and what you want to throw out. And there's so much to go through and so much to process. And it's so painful because you've spent your whole life building this beautiful edifice, and then it's just gone. You know, sometimes it's just in a moment, but it's gone, and you've got to start to rebuild, and you've got to, and the rebuilding takes longer and it's harder, because you've got to look at every single thing that you're using as a foundation for your life once you leave that space and make sure that it's going to hold, because you don't want to build another building that's just going to crumble.
I love that analogy. I'm thinking, yeah, you want to start to build a foundation that either looked similar mm-hmm. or felt similar, because, you know, I went through the phase of really trying to hang on to God and Christ for a long time. And I didn't touch the Ehrman books for a while because I felt like, you know, I've got enough scary stuff that I'm dealing with right now. I don't want to touch deconstructing the Bible for a little while.
Well, the funny thing is, like, my exposure to Ehrman books, I was so naive going into it, because I was just fed up with, you know, the modern Mormon church, the corporation. And so I'm like, okay, well, I'm gonna jump into Christianity. And I was reading this article online, and they mentioned, I believe it was Misquoting Jesus. I'm like, okay, I'll read that book. You know, that'll tell me more about how the Bible was made. And I don't think a lot of people want to know. Like, when I talk to people about textual, like, I got into it. I was reading weird Oxford Press, you know, books that cost $25 and are 120 pages of somebody's thesis sort of stuff.
That was you were following footnotes.
That was all like textual criticism, right? And it was just like, nobody wants to hear that from me because, A, the first question, and there's a whole other thing. The first question you get asked when you're like, you know, I don't really believe in the church anymore. It's like, well, you still believe in Christ, right?
Yeah.
And it's just like, well, describe to me what, A, describe to me what belief in Christ is supposed to look like, and B, no, not really. You know, I'm
not the same, not the same way they describe it, or, you know,
yeah, the Jesus of Nazareth from the Bible, I can tell you, did not exist. Now, whether a man existed that those stories are sort of based on is to me where the debate is open. But the individual described in the four Gospels, yeah, that dude didn't exist, you know, just based on everything you can see, you know. But what are you going to do? I mean, this is so important to a lot of people, and so I just kind of let it go for the most part, because as silly as it seems to me now, and as silly as it is for me to have somebody like, oh, I'm at a testimony meeting and people are talking about, oh, I'm so grateful that Christ exists and he's there to bear our burdens, and I'm like, to me it's like what I'm hearing is, I'm so grateful that a shepherd 2,000 years ago understands what it's like for me to go through a divorce. That doesn't make any sense. You know, I mean, you can compound it with, you could say an illiterate shepherd from 2000 years ago who was a Jewish zealot who was trying to reform the Jewish church, but he knows exactly what it feels like for me when I can't pay my bills every month. That, it, you know, you might as well be saying the same thing about Harry Potter or, you know, any of the myriad of characters from Lord of the Rings or Game of Thrones, because this symbol that people have built up in their lives and this symbol of Jesus doesn't exist anywhere in history. From my point of view, of course, but it doesn't. But anyhow, we tangented again. I'm kind of the king of tangents, so I'm sorry.
That's totally fine. You know, the Ehrman book that really killed it for me, because I think I went through Misquoting Jesus and the Gospels. I don't remember which one that one was. And then I went through God's Problem. Now, I don't know if you've read that one.
I don't think I've read that one.
That was a brutal destroyer for me. That was the one that I put it down, and I thought, I don't think I could ever look at the New Testament ever the same way ever again. It was brutal for me.
That's what I tell people. Like, when people are asking me what I'm going through, and I'm like, A, you probably don't really want to know, and B, even if you're curious about Mormonism, you know, unless you really want to get into it, don't start studying early Christianity, because I'll be honest, the Book of Mormon is pretty, from my point of view, is pretty easy to detect as a, well, not just from my point of view, from a reasonable person's point of view, is pretty easy to detect as a 19th century document, right? And so it's easy to see how it was put together. Once you look at it from outside, it's easy to see that somebody could come up with that book. It's not that hard. You know, 30-some-odd% of it is just straight up pulled from the King James Bible. But when you start looking at the New Testament and how that sausage was made, you can't unsee that. And most people don't stop to even consider where the Bible came from. I mean, when you get into the Old Testament and the P sources versus the J sources and the E sources and all of this and how that all got compiled and when it was all actually written down, most people I know who are still engaging with the church, like seriously engaging with the church, they still look at the Bible the way that Ken Ham does, as a historically accurate document.
Well, yeah, because if it has "This is God's Word" on the cover, does it really matter, like, who authored it or who, you know, copied it from this person, this person? But none of that really matters.
But I think that matters entirely. That's one of those
things. Well, it matters to you and to me. But
when I was,
you know,
I was going through New Testament stuff, it was just like, wait a second. Half of what's attributed to Paul wasn't actually written by Paul.
True, but if you're going under the guise of, this is God's holy word, this is what he meant for us in our
then
day.
Then God's a shitty editor, Tom.
God's not a shitty editor. Man is. Yeah. See, he's allowing man to. Dude, don't put me in this place, man. I'm back.
Oh, come on. Making somebody believe in Bent is fun.
I'm getting dizzy. I'm channeling Witherspoon. No, this is not good.
No. But that was important to me, because where it comes from is material. Like what we're taught in terms of as far as it was translated correctly, that implies in what we're taught that the originals or the autographs were straight up okay, and that whatever's fucked up was lost in translation. But that's not the case. You know, the autographs on which all the translations were based were just as jacked as the translations later on.
Yeah.
When you find out that none of the gospels were written by anybody that we know, that they weren't named until, you know, 400 years later, that's material to me, because I wasn't taught that. I was taught that when the Bible came to be and these originals were written, that they were straight up right and they were the gospel. And then that over years of translation, everything got mucked up. But that's not what happened.
Yeah, I hated it when Ehrman says the closest legitimate gospel we have is Mark.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking, Mark, when was the last time someone said, hey, have you looked in Mark chapter 4? Or that like never happens. And I thought,
no.
What about the Gospel of John, which I consider the most beautiful?
Oh, it was my favorite. That was my favorite. Because it was like, it's full of this wonderful prose and these beautiful stories. And like my favorite story is the woman taken into adultery, where he's, you know, Jesus is drawing pictures in the dirt and saying, you know, any of you have sins, go ahead and cast the first stone. And everybody's like, and of course, in real life, what would happen is some asshole would be like, okay,
some asshole or smart ass.
Or it's like the Monty Python sketch where it's like, you know, all I said was, you know, that halibut was good enough for Jehovah. And like everybody's anyhow.
Blessed are the cheesemakers. Speak up.
But that was material to me. Like, who wrote it? Because when you sit in Sunday school, you just hear the Bible was right. And, you know, there were just translation errors. And that's why we have the Book of Mormon, because it clarifies everything, which it doesn't. But
Okay.
Anyhow, sorry. Tangent again.
So I think we're getting close to wrapping it up.
Yeah.
But I want to end with this, because this is towards the end. And I feel like it's the crux of your essay, where you're explaining the situation with your cousin, and you definitely sound genuinely hurt by her passing this judgment on you,
mm-hmm.
of you losing your light, and then you use the experience that, you know, maybe I was just having a bad day. Have you ever thought of that?
Mm-hmm.
Does that still hurt just like it did then, or has that gone away a little bit, or do you still feel like the believing members, or whether they're being your family or friends or just a random person who's passing judgment on you, does that still bother you and hurt?
It depends on the person. Of course, that particular experience was the first time that I had recognized it. The first time that I realized that somebody in my family, and that somebody that I loved, had shifted me over to another column in the way that they perceived the world. And that's what hurt the most, was just that, to me, and especially at that point, I was still like exactly the same guy. It's just I didn't believe what they believed. I was still, you know, with the exception of paying tithing, I was straight up doing all the Mormon stuff. You know, at that time I wasn't drinking. Well, that's pretty much, I wasn't having coffee, and those are the two things.
But you weren't paying your back tithing, though.
Well, no, because
no, I get you.
You know what I mean? And so for me, there's still a sting with that, because that was the first time that I realized it, you know, and it made me realize that maybe even some of the people that are being really cool with me are still looking at me that way. But the thing is, I have to be okay with that, because I can't change it. There's nothing I can say to someone, and everybody's been so cool with me, but there's nothing I can say to someone who's going to make them look at me the same way they would if I was an Elders Quorum president or a bishop right now.
And I wonder if you would have felt that way if you hadn't been that person previously to your other cousin when you passed that judgment. So you knew what it was like to look at somebody that way and to move them from one column to another.
And that's probably what it was. It was so rugged to read that, because it was just like, I mean, first of all, knowing that somebody's looking at you differently, but second of all, being like, oh, this is what it feels like. This is what I did to somebody. This is how I treated another human person, somebody that I care about. And it, at the time, it doesn't really feel like, you feel like you're doing it from a space of caring. But when you're on the receiving end, you don't feel like it's being done from a space of caring. And I'm the cousin that I did that to, I've since apologized to. And
did he stay in the church or did he leave?
She did not.
Did not what?
Stay in the church.
Okay. So so now you two are in the same column together, and yep. You like
the bulk of that part of my extended family is in the apostate column now.
Yeah.
So, but it's, you know, so yes, I do still like have some negative feelings towards that experience. However, I can't control that narrative. I can't control what people think about me as much as I want to, but I can't. So
no, but it doesn't take away the pain that you still might experience.
Like I said, it depends on the person. You know, when people, there's people that can say things and I might interpret it a certain way. You asked a question a while ago about whether or not I'm judgmental, and it seems like I'm not. No, I'm horribly judgmental. But I feel like I can just maintain that judgment to myself and let people be who they are. You know, whether or not I agree with it is irrelevant in their life. Nobody needs to know that I think they're being X, Y, or Z. So I'm horribly judgmental. I'm just quiet about it.
Okay, so like if there's a family member, a friend who's a believer and they're extremely homophobic, you don't walk up to them and say, hey, man, you know, this is stupid.
I draw the line at a few things.
Okay, so there are lines in the sand.
Yeah,
there.
Like, you know, unethical treatment of people for their sexual identity is unacceptable. It just doesn't make any sense to me. And I'll draw a line there and I'll say, like, mostly I'll just say, you know, you don't know what the hell you're talking about. You know, you're speaking. When you're doing that, you're speaking from a position that you don't understand. You know, I'm again.
But if you come up to him and say you don't know what the hell you're talking about, that instant confrontation right there.
I mean, I'm kind of an asshole anyway.
You're kind of an asshole. I mean, because I was going to say that's the kind of thing that Mike T does. Like when he comes to me,
I don't say it like that. I'm really smooth about the way I put things, but that's again why I think a lot of people haven't, you know, just shunned me or walked away from our relationships, because when you say things a certain way and you allow a super wide berth for people to interpret what you're saying however they want to, that's going to make their worldview work, then you're able to say things. But again, when you're dealing with gay people and even with any sexual identity stuff, mostly it's just bringing up that we don't really know enough about it, because while there's been a ton of research about it in that regard, we don't know enough about it to say that here are these lines. And if somebody wants to start arguing scripture with me, man, you can make the Bible say whatever you want. The Bible is the ultimate ventriloquist dummy, because no matter what you believe, no matter how horrible or how good, something in the Bible is going to support it. It doesn't matter what it is.
Cannibalism?
Yep. I'll find it. All right. I'm just messing with you. Now, cannibalism might be out. Right. No, it's talked about.
Found the loophole.
But
not as a good
thing. I'm talking about what normal people do, Glenn.
You can't justify it. Yeah. Are you telling me that my cravings for human flesh aren't normal?
Yes.
Man.
And I urge you to see somebody about a professional.
Yeah, go to a therapist, one that doesn't look delicious.
Please, yeah. make sure they don't look succulent.
Don't.
But I don't know. I lost where we were going. We did that thing again.
No, it's all right. But I think this is a good place to wrap up. Is there anything final you want to say? Like if any of your family members are out there passing judgment on you, and this is the only way that they're going to hear you explain something.
God, the ones who would pass judgment on me, I don't think would listen to your podcast.
Well, you don't give enough credit to our podcast, dude.
No, I just know my loved ones. You know. Now, don't get me wrong. Yours is one of the only podcasts I don't listen to on 2x speed.
Really?
Yeah.
You hear that, Glenn?
I've been with you all from the start, man. I even gave you how high is the highest on iTunes? Is it 4 stars?
8.
5.
5. I gave you a 5-star review. Y'all started out and it was a little weird because you were doing something different, and then you hit your stride, and I love the podcast. So,
well, Keith, you're one of my favorite listeners, man. For sure.
But no, I don't know. I just try and tell people, be, you know, it's the old Bill and Ted's thing.
Be excellent to each other. Party on, dudes.
Be be excellent to each other. Be cool. You know, don't be a dick. And sometimes people will be assholes still. And that's okay, because, again, they're going to disqualify themselves from being involved in your life. And if that happens, it's painful and it sucks and it hurts. But in the long run, do you really want to hang out with somebody who doesn't want to hang out with you or doesn't want to validate the fact that you're a living person who's had an experience? And so I've always just kind of approached it that way. Be cool to people. Let them, you know, as long as they're not being like Mike T, then let sleeping dogs lie, man.
I couldn't agree more, dude. I mean, anyone who comes on this podcast and says, be excellent to each other, quotes from Bill and Ted's, you're all right in my book, man. I mean, we're one step away from, you know, the Big Lebowski saying, the dude abides.
The dude abides. I mean,
perfect. Perfect.
All right, cool.
Hey, man.
How do you do, dude?
I wondered if I'd see you again.
I wouldn't miss the semis. How things been going?
You know, strikes and gutters, ups and downs.
Sure, I've got you.
Yeah. Thanks, Gary. Well, take care, man. Gotta get back.
Sure. Take it easy, dude.
Oh, yeah.
I know that you will.
Yeah, well, the dude abides.
The dude abides.
And it came to pass that I, Keith, having lived my days in the land south of the river called Jordan, do make a record of my proceedings among the people of the Quorum. And it came to pass that having listened to many podcasts that came forth from the font of knowledge called the Internet, and yea, Infants on Thrones being the only podcast that I listened to at normal speed, an angel of the Lord appeared unto me and said, lo, fear not, for thou canst comment on this episode at the website called infantsonthrones.com. And verily, should thou desire it, thou canst also leave a review and 5-star rating on iTunes, because verily the Quorum doth need their ego stroked. And it came to pass that I did write a review, and left a 5-star rating, and the angel said unto me, well done, thou good and faithful servant. Because thou hast been diligent in a few things, thou shalt be blessed with many podcasts to come. Doth any of ye desire to offer the closing prayer?
Take me down, little Susie, take me down. I know you think you're the queen of the underground. Send me dead flowers every morning. Send me dead flowers by the mail. Send me dead flowers to my wedding. And I won't forget to put roses on your grave. I won't forget to put roses on you.